This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. I'm Rick Pantaleo, sitting in for Carol Castiel. South Korea's National Assembly has voted overwhelmingly to impeach its first female leader, President Park Geun-hye, who has been entangled in a multi-million-dollar influence-peddling scandal. 234 members of the 300-seat South Korean parliament, including members of her own political party, voted for impeachment. The vote means Park's powers have been suspended until the country's constitutional court determines whether or not to remove her from office. The court has up to 180 days to make their decision. Park's presidential powers, meanwhile, have been transferred to South Korea's prime minister, Hwang Kyo-un. As news of the impeachment spread, huge crowds of South Koreans jammed the streets in front of the National Assembly building in Seoul to celebrate. Today on Encounter, we'll discuss South Korea's political crisis as well as other Asia-Pacific matters. My co-host for today's program is Eun Jung Cho from VOA's Korean service. Joining us in our VOA studio is Frank Januzzi, president and CEO of the Maureen and Mike Mansfield Foundation, an organization that promotes understanding and cooperation in U.S.-Asia relations. And Bruce Klingner, senior research fellow for Northeast Asia at the Heritage Foundation's Asian Studies Center, joins us from the studios of the Heritage Foundation here in Washington, D.C. Frank Januzzi, I guess my first question is, what is at the root of the scandal that has now led to the impeachment of South Korea's president?
Well, it's a tangled web of influence peddling, but at the core, it's really about what is perceived to be the undue influence over President Park by this advisor, Ms. Choi, who is part of a family that has long been close to President Park and used their position and access to her to feather their own nest. So it's an insider influence peddling scandal, but it is deeply enmeshed in South Korea's economic system, the influence of the chaebol, large industrial conglomerate institutions of South Korea, and also interwoven with the Senuri Party that President Park leads. So untangling it all and following it to its origins may take some time.
I understand that the South Koreans have been protesting on the streets and are looking for the president to either resign or be taken out of office. What's behind these protests? Bruce, can you give us a little background? I understand, along with the allegations that Frank was mentioning a moment ago, that there may be another issue at bay, being that the April 2014 ferry disaster.
Right. As Frank said, it's really a complicated, tangled web that there are legal aspects, and then there are also sort of cultural aspects in that the Korean populace seem to put President Park on a very high pedestal. The four previous South Korean presidents all had either children or siblings accused of corruption. And because President Park had no spouse, no children, and had estranged herself from her siblings, it seemed like she was going to be the one that broke this cycle of corruption. And also, she's a very iconic figure in South Korean history. Both her parents were assassinated. She had to assume the duties of First Lady as a young woman. So she was seen as having sacrificed her life for the country. And it's not even thought that she benefited financially from it, but it was more, in addition to the legal aspects, it was the sense of a great disappointment, a great betrayal. And I think that fueled a lot of the anger that we're seeing in the streets. And then there's also a lot of sort of conspiracy theories, the sort of a bizarre religious aspects to it, the sense that during the tragedy where the Sewol, the ferry overturned, where 300 or so children died, that because President Park was absent from her office, that she wasn't out there sort of personally directing the Coast Guard, then she should be held responsible.
I want to mention about the emotional aspect, because my friends also go out on the streets every Saturday. I think there's a sense of embarrassment that the person who is the representative of South Korea actually took advice from an unqualified person who was only a schoolmaster of a kindergarten. And such embarrassment, I think, is driving people to go out on the streets and, you know, make these vigils.
I understand the connection between the president and her friend advisor goes back a bit, and I believe that Ms. Park had a relationship with Sun Che's father in the past.
That's right. He had had a special role in her life, especially with the loss of her father, almost taking on a kind of a surrogate father role of counsel and advisor. And I think for her, the special attachment to the family was one that superseded a lot of her other political affiliations. And I think the fact that this whole relationship is one that falls outside of official scrutiny, outside of official channels of accountability, is part of the crisis that she's facing now.
Bruce, I understand part of the concern with the relationship was that Ms. Che had access to some documents or some information that really should be at higher levels within the government.
Right. Again, the legal aspects are that Ms. Che, who had no official position whatsoever in the government, had access to classified information, mishandled classified information, as well as had either direct or very strong involvement in decisions about people who were selected for government positions or making policy decisions. So again, I think it's this sense of kind of outrage or embarrassment by the public that an outsider had so much influence. Now, you know, really any president relies not only on inside government officials and advisors, but also outsiders. But I think that there was a sense that this person had too much control. The person was not accountable to anyone. So in a way, it's not so much that it was a corruption that touched President Park, but it was the sense that she showed incredibly poor judgment by being overly reliant on one person. And then when you have the shaman religion aspect, it kind of adds to the sort of bizarre nature of the scandal.
I want to ask my colleague in studio, Enjung Cho. We were talking prior to the program about some of the implications of this calling for the president to be either impeached or resigned from office, and it has a very personal aspect to it, going back to the Sewol Ferry incident. Can you fill us in a little bit about that and its impact?
The anger from the Korean populace comes especially because of the Sewol incident. It took 7 hours for that big ferry to sink, which means there was time to save these people. And of course, relevant people were punished. But then people were questioning, where was the president? This was a very big event, and this was televised at the time. Where was the president? And until now, the president is not giving clear answers what she was doing. She did come up with some alibis, but people still do not believe it. And there are also evidences coming out from the Blue House that a president is actually addicted to plastic surgeries and anti-aging shots. And people are suspecting maybe the president was not sober at the time. Maybe the president was taking plastic surgery at the time. And maybe this led to such tragedy. And that's why people get so angry and emotional.
Frank, any insight into that?
Well, I have nothing to add about the Sewol Ferry tragedy other than to say that it's remarkable today that President Park is polling at zero among youth in Korea. I mean, her numbers have sunk so low, she's in low single-digit popularity rating. So for a president who began her tenure with promising levels of popular support to have fallen so low, she's not just a lame duck. I mean, she's finished politically, whether she resigns or not. The remaining 12 months of her term of office is going to be one during which time the Korean government may have great difficulty moving forward on important decisions that await them.
When we're looking at the scandal in general, you know, we're looking at South Korea's position in the world and especially within the neighborhood of other Asian nations. From what I understand, South Korea is ranked 11th as far as GDP is concerned. How will this impact South Korea economically, Bruce?
Well, the political crisis will have a number of impacts. Yes, economically, there's concerns that the economy, which is already showing signs of slowing down and being sort of overly reliant on exports. During Park's presidency, there were desire to reform the economy, to try to take into account sort of, you know, evolving economic situations to better position South Korea. And really, nothing has moved forward during her presidency. And then when you have now this crisis, the sense that perhaps South Korea is not worth investing in, there's a concern that it'll drive investors away, and that the uncertainty of who the next president will be, you know, uncertainty is not something that investors like to see. When you combine it with what's called the Korea discount, which is because of the overhanging North Korean threat. That already sort of is taken into account when considering investing in South Korea. And then on the policy side, it's more likely now that a progressive or a liberal candidate would succeed President Park in the presidency, and a progressive president would be more likely to try to undo many of the things that President Park implemented, which the U.S. liked, such as deciding to deploy a ballistic missile defense system called the THAAD, augmenting pressure and sanctions on North Korea, severing some South Korean economic projects with North Korea, and reaching out and trying to improve relations with Japan through a comfort woman agreement as well as a military intelligence sharing agreement. The concern by some, including myself, would be that a progressive president would try to undo those, in essence, sort of pushing the U.S. and Japan to arm's length away and reaching out or embracing not only North Korea but also China to a greater degree.
Frank, can we get a little background on THAAD?
Sure. And Bruce is really one of the international experts on this system. But to build on what he's saying, you know, the OECD has recently essentially downgraded their expectations about Korean growth, but only modestly in response to this crisis. So the economic impact will be real from the uncertainty, but probably not dramatic. But where the real changes may occur is on things like THAAD. Now, this is an anti-missile defense system. It is optimized for the kinds of intermediate and medium-range missiles that North Korea possesses and is proceeding to develop. Its deployment to South Korea is controversial for many reasons, in part because China, which sees this defensive anti-missile system as sort of the narrow end of the wedge of South Korea being integrated into a global anti-missile U.S.-led system, China has been strenuously opposing South Korea's decision to deploy this system. It's also controversial inside South Korea because, you know, frankly, a lot of the South Korean people are within artillery range of North Korea. So while the anti-missile system may defend U.S. bases and defend some key military installations around the country, it's not going to be effective in countering the massive numbers of artillery tubes that can range Seoul. So I think many South Koreans see it more as an extension of the U.S. alliance defending the alliance rather than defending the South Korean people.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My co-host today is In Jung Cho from VOA's Korean service. Our guests are Bruce Klingner, Senior Research Fellow at the Heritage Foundation's Asian Studies Center, and Frank Januzzi, President and CEO of the Mansfield Foundation. We are discussing current political upheaval in South Korea as well as other parts of the Pacific. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow Carol Castiel on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA. Let's get back to our program. With the South Korean political crisis, we can't help but look at the reaction from two countries, China and, of course, North Korea. Bruce Klingner, I am especially curious about North Korea's reaction to this scandal.
Well, at first they were quiet, but now they, I think, are gleefully reporting on it and taking great pleasure in the troubles of South Korea. But, you know, they have not taken advantage of it in the sense of conducting any kind of provocation or intrusion or tactical level clash. And really, that's to North Korea's benefit. If they were to do another missile test, a nuclear test, or some kind of clash, in a way, it would distract the South Korean populace away from their quest to oust the South Korean president. So North Korea, I think, will remain quiet for a while to take advantage of this situation, which they see as working to their advantage because it's more likely a progressive candidate would follow President Park. You know, on the other hand, people always expect that a North Korean regime will do some kind of provocation in the run-up or shortly after inauguration of either a South Korean or a U.S. president. We know from senior North Korean defectors, they like to do that early in the term of a U.S. and South Korean president, in their words, to train them like a dog, to make them respond to North Korea.
Frank, there has been a push recently for the U.N. to increase sanctions against North Korea. How will this scandal play into that?
Well, the new sanctions that the U.N. has adopted have some interesting elements, the most important of which is a quota on the North Korean export of coal to China. This could have some significant economic impact on North Korea, and it appears that China is prepared to implement these new sanctions. What's less clear is how North Korea will respond. Ordinarily, as Bruce has said, in response to pressure, they have signs of defiance, nuclear tests, missile tests. But in this particular instance, their response even to the sanctions so far has been somewhat muted, I think out of concern that they not jeopardize the evolving situation in South Korea that could evolve in a way that is to their advantage if a more moderate or progressive government takes power, one which is less interested in sanctions and pressure on the North. There's some eerie parallels here to 2008. When Obama was elected, he had offered dialogue to North Korea. North Korea met that offer with a missile test and then a nuclear test, perhaps to show how tough they were going to be. Donald Trump himself, I'm not sure with what seriousness, but he did sort of offer up the idea that he could negotiate with Kim Jong-un. He talked about a hamburger summit.
Bruce, South Korea and the United States had a wonderful relationship working together. Frank brings up a very good point. We've got a new administration coming in. We've President-elect Donald Trump coming in. Now, how's the scandal going to impact the work that Donald Trump will be doing regarding relationship with Korea?
Well, just as there's the uncertainty of what will happen in South Korea and how it'll play out, it's prevented South Korea or the South Korean president from really reaching out to President-elect Trump and establishing the beginnings of a relationship as a Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe has been able to do, not only through a phone call, but through a visit. So the South Korea is not able to establish that relationship. And then there's also a lot of uncertainty and concern, not only in Seoul and Tokyo, but in the capitals of other allies about things that Mr. Trump said during the campaign. He seemed to make alliances conditional on the host nations paying 100% of the cost of U.S. forward deployed forces in those countries. You know, I would argue that alliances are based on principles and national interests shared with other democracies as opposed to a business relationship. But the idea that perhaps the Americans would walk if they don't receive 100% payment, you know, has caused a lot of trepidation and concern. Also, he's seemingly acquiesced to Japanese and South Korea nuclear programs, although he later denied he said that. And as Frank said, his views on North Korea, he's never mentioned sanctions, but instead sort of one extreme is having a hamburger summit with Kim Jong-un. The other extreme is pressuring China to take him out in any way possible, sort of what I'd call the Godfather option of leave the gun, take the cannoli. But we don't really know what his policies will be. Now, since the election, he's had positive phone calls with Park and Abe and others. His statements seem to be more moderate than what he said during the campaign. And then also, as we see his selections for senior positions, certainly General Mattis, who's the Secretary of Defense designate, he would be very much in favor of alliances given his many decades in the United States Marine Corps. So we're all scouring for clues based on who he chooses and what both Mr. Trump and any of those people say. But, you know, in international affairs, uncertainty is not a good thing. Perhaps in business negotiations it is. So our allies are looking for reassurance.
Frank, do you see China benefiting from this ongoing scandal in South Korea?
It's a really good question. I'm not sure that China sees it that way. There may be some short-term tactical advantage. The difficulties in South Korea for President Park make it more likely that South Korea will bend ultimately to China's will on the THAAD system, for instance. There may also be some tactical advantage for China from the demise of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement. Donald Trump has said that he will start from scratch. He also has expressed a preference for bilateral trade agreements. Although South Korea was not a member of the TPP states, they were destined to be one of the first of the second round countries to join TPP. This would have more closely aligned the South Korean economy with that of the United States and Japan. And so China, I think, is seeing an opportunity here to expand their own economic influence with South Korea. But longer term, I'm not sure that this instability works to China's advantage. Instability on the peninsula can come back to bite China, and I think they've got to be worried about how things are going to unfold on the peninsula.
Frank, speaking of China, recently President-elect Donald Trump had a conversation with the president of Taiwan.
Well, it's really fascinating. You know, we've heard three different sort of narratives from the Trump administration about the phone call with President Tsai Ing-wen of Taiwan. One came from Vice President Pence over the weekend, where he basically said, look, this is no big deal. It's not a change in policy. He's just the president-elect, and he was answering a call from a friend. But you've also had, subsequent to that, a series of reports in the Washington Post, the New York Times. No, this was a carefully planned diplomatic overture designed to put China on notice that the United States was going to take a tougher line. And then you have Donald Trump himself tweeting about it with a sort of a third version, which essentially is, well, hey, China doesn't consult me when they devalue their currency. Why do I need to consult them about phone call with the Democratic friend? So it's really hard for all of us watching to know exactly what's going on. I think the one thing we can say with some certainty is that, as Bruce pointed out, you know, this lack of clarity on the part of President Trump has certainly got Beijing's attention. They are now on their guard, looking for any shift in U.S. policy with respect to Taiwan. And I think you can expect them to react rather swiftly and severely if they see the Trump administration continuing to move down a path that would see a significant enhancement in the U.S. commitment to Taiwan.
Frank, you said severely. What do you mean severely?
Well, one analyst in Beijing, a very respected professor, Shunding Li, who is considered to be a moderate voice in Beijing, has warned that China could, in fact, recall its ambassador and essentially downgrade U.S.-China relations if President Trump were to proceed to establish closer quasi-official ties to the Taiwanese government. I think he was laying down a marker there that the Chinese consider Taiwan to be a core interest and that the United States should not underestimate how powerful an issue this is for China. I had a Chinese friend explain it to me this way. Imagine if the U.S. Civil War, and this is China's perspective, not mine, but imagine if the Civil War had never ended, that instead Jefferson Davis and General Lee had decamped to Cuba, where they set up a government that claimed still to be the legitimate government of the Confederate States of America, and 7 decades later they were still there. You know, how would the United States feel if the French had diplomatic relations with the government on Cuba? So, you know, the Chinese view this very emotionally. It's central to who they are, so I don't think we should take lightly any change in U.S. posture.
Final question. Can you provide us with more of an idea of what we might expect from a post-POC scenario in South Korea? What kind of government?
Well, we're not sure how it'll play out, but I think there's a greater likelihood that a progressive president will follow Park Geun-hye. The progressive parties have said that they are against the deployment of THAAD. And sort of imagine the scenario if an advisor goes into President Trump's office and says, sir, our ally is refusing to allow us to improve the protection for the 28,500 sons and daughters we've deployed to South Korea to defend them. He may not take that very kindly. You know, in addition to that, we, as I've said before, is a greater resistance to implement the UN resolution sanctions, a greater willingness to reach out to North Korea, perhaps try to resurrect the inter-Korean economic venture at Kaesong, which is actually very likely to be in violation of UN resolutions given the lack of transparency in how the wages are paid to the workers. You know, a resistance to the President Park's Comfort Women Agreement to overcome historic differences between Japan and South Korea, the Intelligence Sharing Agreement, a greater resistance to what I believe is the necessary integration of this independent South Korean missile defense system into the more effective allied system, and a greater willingness to abide by Chinese pressure on not only THAAD, but on other issues. So all of those are going to cause strains in the relationship with Washington, and we could, you know, kind of a worst case, see the rise of anti-Americanism like we saw during the last progressive president, Ngo Myuhan.
Frank Januzzi, Bruce Klingner, and Injung Chu, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my co-host, Injung Cho from VOA's Korean Service, as well as our guests, Bruce Klingner, Senior Research Fellow at the Heritage Foundation, and Frank Januzzi, President and CEO of the Mansfield Foundation. Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anya Zaleski for booking our guests. Our engineer for today's program was Calvin Fowler. I am Rick Pantaleo, sitting in for Carol Castiel. Join us again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.